Voices of November 30th. Hi, I'm SW Conser, also known as Conch. In 1999, I was a morning news anchor for KBOO Radio, and like many hundreds of other Oregonians, I headed north on Monday, November 29th, to see what would happen when trade ministers from around the world converged on Seattle at the same time as activists from the labor, environmental, and human rights movements. 10 years later, the events of November 30th are still reverberating far beyond the Pacific Northwest. So I invited half a dozen Portlanders into the studio to talk about that day and the lasting effects that it had for them and for activist communities around the world. Lori King, an activist with Portland Jobs with Justice, Patricia Rumer with Jubilee Oregon, Andrea Townsend, who was 10 years ago a student activist at Franklin High School, and from KBOO, Andrew Geller, Rolf Semperbon, and Daniel Flessis.
Okay, my name's Lori King, and for the last, let's see, about 14, 15 years, I've been working with Portland Jobs with Justice as a volunteer activist and also as a staff person. Back in 1999, I was very interested in helping mobilize and educate union members about what was going on and what would be going on in Seattle, and encourage people to go and be part either of the labor rally or the civil disobedience, but to really encourage people to go there and understand what was going on. A number of us were working with the Cross Border Labor Organizing Coalition and Jobs with Justice to bring, you know, the whole issue of cross border organizing into our work. So we were encouraging people for years, I mean really since 1994, to see what was going on with labor struggles in Latin America, mainly Latin America and Central America, and see how our struggles here were connected, and that it's really important to support the struggles in this global South to raise the floor for everyone worldwide. The challenge that I set myself was to really be a bridge between different groups of peoples, and I knew that there was going to be the civil disobedience, and I was excited about it, and I wanted to really encourage like labor people to either participate in it or to understand it and support it. So that's something that we did in Jobs with Justice, is we encourage people to go to Seattle, to know what the WTO is about, to see how it was so harmful for all of us, you know, working people in the whole world, and to go to Seattle and to protest the WTO in whichever way they felt comfortable. So we were very open about that there were these different possibilities of things that people could do.
My name is Pat Rumer, and I am very active with Jubilee Oregon. It began in the late 1990s as Jubilee 2000, and it began in the Global South, in Africa in particular, where people like Bishop Tutu and others looking at the tremendous debt burden that sub-Saharan Africa was carrying, joined together with people like Adolfo Perez Esquivel from Argentina. So the Jubilee 2000 movement began in the Global South, but then put out a call to those in the North. I had lived in Latin America before. I knew a little bit about the Mexico early 90s when it almost went bankrupt. And so I thought, well, maybe I could do something. So I was working at Portland State at that time and reached out to some other faculty people and returned Peace Corps volunteers and some religious congregations. And in early 1999, we kind of convened a meeting and we started Jubilee 2000 in Portland, Oregon. And did a variety of kind of teach-ins and educational work, etc. And so when the WTO was being organized, we immediately saw the relationship, and Jubilee 2000 in the U.S., based in Washington, D.C., was very active in organizing a Friday evening event at a Methodist church in Seattle, where I would say probably 3,000 to 3,500 people gathered. So four of us from Jubilee 2000 in Portland traveled north. Myself, a Roman Catholic nun, an Episcopal priest, and a woman who was really excited about the WTO rally around the environment. So you wouldn't say we were exactly the people that they were scared of in Seattle. But that's part of the interesting thing to me, is to who saw the possibilities for forming new kinds of coalitions by the environmental groups, the debt cancellation groups, the trade justice groups, labor unions, religious organizations, youth, women, just all kinds of people showed up in Seattle.
So my name's Andrea Townsend, and when I, in 1999, I went up to Seattle as a high school student. I was a junior at Franklin High School in Portland, Oregon, and I went up with about 10 students that were in a global studies class with me and in our sixth period global studies class, and also a bunch of Unitarian youth from the local Portland Unitarian, First Unitarian Church. And we basically, we organized a youth and young adult conference at a church in Bellevue so that we could have a place to stay and be able to go to the conference that the International Forum on Globalization put together and then attend the protests on Monday and Tuesday. So, yeah, it was really exciting to be that young and to have this huge protest to look forward to. And I definitely had no idea, like, what was going to happen. I know, like, for the months beforehand, we'd been attending teach-ins and learning about the WTO and some of our social studies classes and talking about it amongst ourselves. And we, you know, thought that it was going to be big. But when we got there, we had no idea that it was going to be quite as large and as amazing as it ended up being. I feel like I had a lot of responsibility on my shoulders for a 16-year-old that we arranged with several local churches to find sponsors for youth so that we'd have adults that would be with us. And we organized ourselves into affinity groups so that people would be able to be with people that they trusted when they were in the protest. And, you know, so that their parents would feel comfortable letting them go up to Seattle. I remember my friend Leela, who was one of my co-organizers, she told her parents that if they didn't let her go to Seattle, she was going to run away from home and go anyway. So, and then they decided that it would be okay. And my parents actually decided to go with us. My mom has been a labor activist for the past 30 years in her union, and she was definitely concerned about the effect of the World Trade Organization. And my dad's a social justice activist, and they also, you know, their daughters were going up to Seattle, so they wanted to make sure that we'd be okay.
So my name's Andrew Geller, and 10 years ago, in November of 1999, I'd been a reporter, but I was also a weekly public affairs host Wednesday mornings doing a show then called Voice of Cascadia. I decided to, you know, I was thinking, oh, wow, you know, maybe I should go up and check this out. And wow, wouldn't it be a kick if I actually got press credentials from the World Trade Organization? All these entities holding all these big conferences have media accreditation. Now websites, I guess there was a website even back then, and you just simply apply. I think they also required a signed letter from an assignment editor. Someone else needs to say, yeah, you're legit. Having an actual FCC licensed broadcast facility also helps. The idea that you were a freelancer with no affiliation tended then to hurt your chances of getting accredited. But yeah, it was simply I applied.
My name is Rolf Semprebon. I'm a KBOO volunteer. I just kind of at the last minute, Monday, the day before the WTO protest, I heard on KBOO, actually, that their Jobs with Justice was doing these, was taking people up there for $25. And I thought, God, there's no reason I shouldn't not go. So I did that. I called them up and arranged that to happen. You know, because I was kind of thinking of going, and I was procrastinating and stuff. But at the end, I just thought, you know, this is not going to be some, you know, just another small thing. I just thought this was going to be pretty major.
So when we got there Friday night, of course it was raining. You know, what can you say? And there were so many people in this Methodist church really packed to the rafters that they had to open up a side room where they had televisions which carried what was going on in the big room. And people, you know, were on their feet. They were chanting. We were singing, you know, what do we want? We want debt canceled now, etc. And after kind of a rousing rally, 3,500 of us poured out onto the wet streets of Seattle at night. And we marched from that church, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of it or the location, but it was kind of on a hill. And we walked down a hill, and we ended up surrounding the conference center where the WTO meeting was going to be held. And because the theme of Jubilee 2000 was break the chains of debt. So in surrounding the WTO Conference Center, we were holding hands, standing there in the pouring down rain, chanting, break the chains of debt.
I remember we woke up in this church in Bellevue, and we'd coordinated workshops with trainers on civil disobedience, on affinity groups, on sort of decision-making processes. And we didn't really map out exactly where we were going to go, but we knew where the main protest was going to start. So we figured out how we were going to get there on public transportation. And we, you know, organized ourselves into these groups. We had, you know, each, I think we had about five or six people in each affinity group. And then they had one or two adults, sponsors with them. And then it's kind of fuzzy. Like I remember being downtown and sort of, but I don't remember like being on the bus getting down there. But then we sort of just started wandering around the city. At one point we went to 420 Denny Street, which was the warehouse where a lot of the, direct action was being planned. And like, it was such an interesting place. Like there was all this graffiti and like these beautiful murals on the outside of it. And we went in and I just remember like all these different sights and smells. Like people were cooking food and making lunches over in this part. And these people had maps and they were like planning out like where they were going to lock down. And like some people were like making big puppets and banners. And we didn't stay for very long. We didn't really have a role there. It seemed like a lot of organizing was like happening in that place. So, but it was cool to be able to like experience it for a little bit.
My name's Daniel Flessis. I went up with a lot of youth, high school kids, my son, his girlfriend, and a couple others with my friend's daughter. And so I remember we got up quite early in the morning, you know, about 4 or 5 in the morning, and went down to the first intersection that we got to that was near the Paramount that was locked down. I don't call what was officially going on at the Paramount. I just remember that we headed down there, and at the moment that it was decided that we should block the intersection and everybody sat down and we locked arms under the tubes, what I noticed by looking down the hill was that it was simultaneously going on. And I was impressed. It was simultaneously going on in other intersections. As an activist who has been in a lot of, I've been involved in a lot of actions that were not as well planned. Let's put it that way. And I was knocked out by the fact that we at the same moment were basically stopped traffic throughout that whole area of Seattle. And it was, everything was gridlocked, and there was nothing anybody could do about it. It was a moment where the uninvited finally said, no, you cannot just ignore the people. And I think it was a catalyzing moment for not just the youth that were with me. I mean, this was the first time in which they could see that, you know, as I said, the people shall not be ignored, but a lot of people my age and other people that were involved thought, my God, we really can shut down a city.
Well, yeah, I remember marching out of Seattle Center after watching all these speakers like kick off the march. And I think we were like up in the back in the bleachers with just this huge sea of people in front of us. And then marching down to Seattle Center, and there was that giant green condom that was like sailing over the crowd that was telling the WTO to practice safe trade.
So after that kind of, you know, we're all up on our feet and we're yelling and we're applauding and we're feeling the energy, we all poured out and started walking. And in some ways, the walking was a little bit of a letdown after the rally because, you know, we were confined in a stadium and you could, you know, we're echoing off each other and, you know, it's a big group. And then when you start walking, you know, there were a lot of people on the street, and you're really spread out over maybe, I don't know, probably a couple of miles at that point, and you can't see the beginning, and I was in the middle, and you can't see the end. And but the atmosphere on the street was so much fun. I mean, part of that was all the people who had made their costumes, who made their designs, who were terribly creative in terms of the kind of signs they were carrying. It was just a really good feel to it. Like, we're walking because we really stand for some alternatives. We want those alternatives, and we don't want the WTO.
I remember, we're all looking for like Michael Moore, because at the time, I think the head of the WTO, his name was Michael Moore too. And so we were like, there's Michael Moore. And we didn't know if it was the good Michael Moore or the bad Michael Moore, because you'd hear somebody going, over there, there's the Michael Moore.
Well, some of the experiences there were very interesting. After the labor rally and the labor march, the labor march was marching toward the convention center on November 30th. There was a certain point at which the march was, and I'm saying this in quotes, supposed to turn back. And people were supposed to go back to where the buses were, right near where the rally was. And people were supposed to go home then. And, you know, a lot of people did turn around. There were marshals who were saying, this is where the march ends, turn back. And lots of people said, heck, we're going to go all the way, you know, as far as we can into the area where the WTO is actually being shut down. And that was really quite exciting to see that. There was, you know, a number of people turning back, but lots of people continuing through where, you know, people weren't supposed to go. And a number of us, you know, I went that way, and there were lots and lots of people who did. And we went into the area where there was tear gas, and people were sitting and holding space against the cops. And what was really heartening to me was seeing steelworkers. You know, steelworkers were wearing blue. There were Teamsters in yellow ponchos. There were lots of union people who disobeyed what they were supposed to do, and they kept going.
People were calling it the Woodstock of political action, and you know, like Woodstock, it just happened. I think the magnitude of what happened at the battle in Seattle was not something that people could really plan for. People could hope for it. Of course, we always hope for a lot of people to show up at a demonstration. You know, that's the kind of thing you can't see it coming, and when it hits, there's no stopping it. And I remember we had a huge group of marchers and signs and puppets and turtles and whatever, and we were basically winging it, like we were going down a main street, and then said, well, let's go down this way. And we started going down the hill behind Pike Place Market towards the waterfront. And what was really exciting was while we were headed down that hill, and you could see all the way down to the waterfront, we could see another huge march coming to meet where I could see where we were going to intersect. And sure enough, we did. And we, of course, with the motion, we didn't stop. We just kept going now on the waterfront. Where we had gotten to was perfect timing. The longshoremen's strike had shut down all of the ports throughout the entire west coast of the United States at that moment. All of the longshoremen unions throughout California, Oregon, and Washington had stopped. We learned about that while we had all converged on the dock down on the waterfront. That was a great moment.
I think a lot of people were locking down like around the Paramount Theater, and like there were, I remember these buses had been like, they'd put buses, I guess the people who were organizing the World Trade Organization protest had put buses to sort of blockade the protesters. But then people had taken them over, and so there were like people dancing on top of these buses, like to music that was blasting down the street. Well, I just remember that at one point, my friends and I climbed up on top of this bus, and there were speakers in an intersection down the street that were blasting the YMCA. So we all like did the YMCA on top of this bus, and we were just dancing, and it was great. I mean, that was, yeah. Yeah, we were entertaining the blockaders, like everybody was cheering. There were just sort of crowds of people like milling about at that point. there, I don't remember much of a police presence there. I mean, it was clear that like this, that street had been taken over and like the people had control of it. So yeah, it was pretty amazing.
Yeah. I think people were like really super exhilarated. I mean, I felt like I was walking into like freedom, you know, it just felt like this liberated zone. It was really very exhilarating. And I think a lot of the people around me felt the same thing. You know, we ran into a bunch of friends. We ran into this really older guy who was an old union carpenter. And he was walking in this liberated zone. And he was saying, this is it. This is it. You know, people were really excited that there was this zone where the police, they were held at bay.
Those intersections, we saw shoppers. You know, basically Seattleites who really didn't give a rip about the WTO, and suddenly they were trapped in the intersections with people that were sitting down. And I remember this really distinctly. These were people dressed up in their business clothes and women that were going shopping, trying to get into those stores. And the tanks, would approach, and I go, "Okay, you folks better get ready." And sure enough, then we all started breathing pepper spray.
Talking to people on the street, non-participants. These are people who are like trying to go to work, trying to go to school, just trying to have their regular day. Universally in support of the demonstrations. Inconvenienced, sure. Inconvenience is a drag, no matter what it is. But everyone I talked to seemed to be good-natured about the fact that they were being inconvenienced, because the reason for the inconvenience was worthwhile. It wasn't just like traffic or some, you know, ridiculous thing.
I think it was towards the end of my march, and Sister Lucinda and I were marching together, and we came around a corner, and all of a sudden we were being steered a slightly different way, and the word that came out was that there was some trouble someplace, and that's all we knew. So, you know, for us, it was a great 24 hours. And Sister Lucinda and I took the bus back, picked up her car. And it was only when we were heading back to Portland and we came downtown again, we had to cross, a bridge somehow to get on the freeway to head south. And we were stopped by the police. And the police said, "You can't go there." And, Sister Lucinda was driving, so the policeman was talking to me, and I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Because there's, violence on the streets, and the streets are closed." I said, "What?" I mean, I really was shocked. I truly was. I just thought, I said to him, "We just came from the march." I said, "We didn't see anything." He said, "Well, believe me, you don't want to go down there." He said, "So you need to take this detour and get on the freeway." And so that was the only inkling I had that there had been some problems with the march. And I mean, I knew there were people who were prepared to commit a nonviolent civil disobedience because there had been a training for that. And that was very clear as to who those people were and what they were going to do. But I didn't know anything more than that.
It seemed, because I would occasionally leave the march and go back or forth. And I noticed that when the labor was marching, the police were like, acted one way. But once the labor disappeared, and it was more the younger, the more radical and anarchist types, the police would act very differently. And they were a lot more being tough and just, ready to crack some skulls. But when the labor, because police are union, and I thought that was, I kind of noticed that. Yeah.
Other things that are really important to remember are that the police use of chemical weapons happened hours before there was any window breaking, hours before there were any people in black causing mayhem. The use of chemical weapons happened either very late morning or very shortly after noon. And it had absolutely nothing to do with the so-called violence, which is a misnomer because you can't be violent against inanimate objects. And another thing that's important to remember about the use of chemical weapons is that the police went so wild in their use of chemical weapons that they ran out before the end of the protests on November 30th. That night, the Seattle Police Department went to McCord Air Force Base and restocked with far stronger military grade CS and OC, which was not what the Seattle police were using during the day on Tuesday. So any chemical weapons used late on Tuesday, November 30th or thereafter were military strength. And I remember talking to a friend of mine, Kirk Murphy, who's a doctor down at UCLA at the time, who assisted a lot with activist campaigns, talking very specifically about how this actually was way more dangerous. And he received numerous reports of people literally dropping to the ground in their tracks where they stood when hit with any of this military grade chemical weapons.
When I was shooting video, the line of cops was marching down the street, and I was in between now the where all of the people had gathered to stop to basically occupy the intersection. And as I was standing on the side, not in the way of the cops, but I stood over on the sidewalk so they could walk by me. And this one cop had a big canister of pepper spray, and he just raised it and held it out to the side facing me and shot it right in my face. And I, you know, of course, suddenly was paralyzed. I couldn't see or I couldn't. And these angels, I was scared because I couldn't breathe. I couldn't see. And there were a lot of people screaming and cops were trampling us. But at that moment, these hands grabbed me and pulled me inside a shop, and suddenly, even though I still couldn't see anything, it was quieter, calmer, and it smelled like flowers, and it was a florist shop.
One of the things that I take from it, it wasn't something that I saw personally, but I saw it in an indie media video, and it was actually of the next day or two when there was a lot of tear gassing still, and it was a woman steelworker who was talking about how this was not on the 30th, so this was a day or two after, but it was a woman steelworker who was talking about how she saw young people being tear gassed. She observed it, and then she and other steelworkers went to support them, and then they got tear gassed, and it was like a real moment of revelation to her that this is how people are treated in this country. And and she was very proud to have been there supporting the people who were being tear gassed. And then, as I said, she got tear gassed herself.
There were some people that, I'll use my son Earthen as an example of someone who wanted to go. He's been raised in a politically aware consciousness, but not necessarily always out in the streets. Well, this was definitely a catalyzing moment for him, because he knew that if you take handkerchiefs and douse them with water, that it helps counteract the pepper spray, and so that's what we were doing. We would choke up and head back to where our mothership was parked, and then we would kind of get inside there and feel kind of safe, and then he'd say we have to go, we have to get back out there. And I said, okay, son, what are you going to do? So that was interesting to see how people were transformed by the energy of the event.
Yeah, I saw a little bit of property destruction, and I don't see how broken glass or theft of sneakers or anything against inanimate objects warrants the type of response that was given by the police. The only instances, let's see, can I say this? I'd like to be able to say with a lot of confidence that the only instances I heard of people being hurt were by police.
I think most of the people there would say that it was the police that were at fault, that they were the ones who started tear gassing and rioting, that it was the police. Those people, even if the newspapers didn't fully explain it and the media didn't fully explain it, they talked to people. You know, case in point, my mom, you know, I told other people when I got back what really happened. So those people know. So the word spread just from the incredible number of people who were there told their circles. And, you know, so that's one big piece of how information got out. And I think that just even the media couldn't hide, you know, what the police did. The media couldn't hide that the WTO is essentially, you know, is essentially flawed and is an economic model that isn't working for us. So, I mean, I think even that model got exposed, you know, things that people had no idea about became something that people spoke about.
Actually, some friends called me because they knew I was going to be up in Seattle, and they said, "Are you okay?" I mean, they called me on Sunday and Monday and said, "Are you all right?" I said, "Yes." It was nothing, you know, and so it was kind of like an unreal experience looking at the newspaper and the media coverage of it, which emphasized the stone throwing or the attacks, you know, in terms of that and whatever other things that the police were trying to do to round up people to clear the streets. You know, I just thought that's not where I was, and that's not what I attended.
Most of the violence and damage that I saw was inflicted by police. And I mean, because you've got peaceful families protesting, and the police at that time were starting a technique, which I saw then used here in Portland. It's an interesting technique in which they back people into a corner and of course people obey and say, okay, we're moving back. But when you look back to where they're backing them into, there'll be another wall of police. It's interesting. I saw it in Seattle. I saw it in Portland, and I saw it on film in Genoa, that you squeeze them out and you're basically trying to cause something to happen so that you can finally depopulate the area and arrest people. It's disgusting because it will work because people don't have anywhere to go. But that's what was happening a lot in Seattle. I noticed that they would when the local Seattle media got pushed along with us a couple of times. We cheered when we went back to our place and watched it on the news and saw that they were saying we weren't doing anything and the police basically attacked. So when they said the police attacked, that was local news. I don't think that the national news would have allowed that to be said.
Right. Well, I think that there's a lot of pressure from the media and in various ways for some people to look at themselves as like the good protesters and other people as the bad protesters. And I feel like there was a lot of growth in keeping that from happening. That was really important. And I think that was followed up in Miami when there was union with an FTAA meeting in Miami in 2003, when there were union people and direct action people that really were very supportive of each other. So it's really, you know, it was really an important growth, I believe, that union people didn't, you know, may have started out as seeing themselves as separate from the direct action, but over the week of activities, that started to really break down. And I think it broke down on November 30th itself. But by the end of the week, there was a labor march that was held by the Labor Council in Seattle. They opened up their buildings to direct action people. All that is really, really important, you know, for our future, for building coalition to really change the economy around.
It was such a powerful and positive experience that we could speak to that and respond to people with what we had actually experienced. And then also engage in that conversation about whether or not property damage is violence. I feel like I had tons of conversations with adults about that. And I still, to this day, have, you know, it's not a question in my mind. I don't think property damage is violence, but a lot of people do, and they criticize the whole WTO protest for that.
You know, because I got home that night, I believe, probably around 10 or 11 o'clock, and I remember turning on the news, and they were just running it continuously. But by then, it was when it was, you know, it was just turning into a kind of a ridiculous sort of skirmishes and stuff. I mean, it was, but it was kind of interesting to see that. But yeah, it was kind of like they're focusing on, you know, these people damaging stuff and stuff like that. And I think, you know, as usual, the major media kind of missed the point of the whole thing. But at the same time, no one knew who the WTO was before this happened. I mean, this is like the secret cabal of unelected people that have, you know, so much control over our lives, and no one even knew who they were. So of all the other things, I mean, the WTO protest, of all the other things it did also expose this thing. And it seems like, you know, as far as I know, that they've had WTO meetings in other places after that, and they've all been kind of, you know, like in Europe, I think they had one in Europe where they were like tipping over cars and stuff, the protesters and stuff. So it's kind of like the only place they really can have a WTO meeting anymore is either some banana republic where, you know, you got the iron rule of, you know, some dictator, or maybe Antarctica, you know, would be a good place, since it's probably getting warmer there now that the climate change is affecting everything.
And another great moment that I remember was, at night, I was with Michael Franti, and we were out on the street, and he was a little confused because he knew that he was supposed to call in an interview at KPFA in Berkeley, and he said, but this is just so much more important. Where we were at that moment was on First Street near the Pike Place Market, and when he was wondering what to do about. You know, it's time, it's 6 o'clock or whatever, it's time I'm supposed to phone in KPFA, what should I do? I looked down the street and saw the tanks approaching. Now, anybody that had been at some of these intersection actions saw the pattern, that the tanks approached, the cops did sort of they just stopped everything, and it was kind of this pregnant pause. And then when the tanks approached, that's when the pepper spray and the tear gas started to come out. So when I saw that the tanks turned the corner at the bottom of the street, I got out my cell phone and I said, Michael, make the call.
I remember leaving Seattle. We had we had decided that that we were going to leave on Tuesday night, and you know, people had to go home and go to school, and like people's parents and let them go to Seattle contingent on them being back on Tuesday. So like, we definitely didn't want to leave. We felt like we really should have stayed and wanted to stay in Seattle, but we couldn't. So it was really heartbreaking driving south on I-5 and looking back through the rearview window and seeing sort of these clouds of tear gas like around the city, and knowing that people that I loved were still there. Like some of them were in jail and being beaten up, and like I didn't know what was happening, but I had to go. And then coming back to Portland and seeing the front page of the Oregonian, these stories about these violent protesters shutting down the WTO. And it was kind of a strange jolt back into reality, I guess, to see how the media had portrayed what had happened versus what I had experienced, which had been, for the most part, very positive. Yeah.
The curfew seemed to me like it was some kind of an epilogue. It didn't really matter so much because of all that we had been doing during the day. And, you know, people just defied it, but I didn't see people getting busted for that curfew. Maybe they were, but I mean, I saw people just saying, you know, let them impose a curfew. It was late in the day when they imposed it. And so it just gave people the energy to say, okay, where? And then people would head for those streets.
Right. It was a perfect storm in our direction. One of the things, I mean, I always look at like the WTO as like, we've been fighting for years. You know, I'm a pretty long-term activist, fighting for years for, you know, an economy that really is, you know, to transform this economy away from a profit-driven corporate managed economy. And it's not easy to do that in those terms. But the WTO suddenly made it possible. I mean, it was like there was a blank wall, and suddenly like this doorknob popped out. And that's what allowed this coalition to form, because the WTO, as like this distillation of corporate managed economy, affects so many different issues, you know, from the environment to labor rights to agricultural rights, intellectual property rights, logging, all of these things are so, you know, that are so managed by the corporations, got distilled into this WTO. So it became this amazing organizing tool that allowed this coalition to form. Now, this coalition has to keep going, because it's the same corporate-driven economy. The WTO is one element of it, and as I said, it's like a distillation, but it's the same economy that we have to transform. So, I mean, that's the perfect storm, that the WTO was so hideously emblematic of the whole corporate-driven economy that it encouraged, you know, they're digging their own graves, and encouraged this coalition to form.
The more we see ourselves as allies rather than enemies, that's, you know, a threat, you know, if you're the established political structure. Because in many ways, the political structure frequently plays a divide and conquer game. And so to me, part of the power was who was at that rally speaking and how they were seeing how their issues related to other people's issues, which had not always been the case before. And the fact that other visions of economic justice and a different world were being laid out. And people were creative. That was what the puppets and the costumes and everything and the songs and the dancing and the music. It wasn't just like a picnic or anything, because it was serious, but there was a sense of joy and creativity and calling that out of people. You know? It was fun.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why everything succeeded the way it did was because it wasn't really expected. People had been training and educating for workshops happened for months beforehand, just like it is happening now with Copenhagen. But I don't think people, certainly within the WTO, I think it really caught everybody with their pants down. The police, all of the forces of the police, because you had state police, you had local Seattle police, and you had National Guard. But I don't think, I know that it caught people by surprise, because it took us by surprise. I mean, just the magnitude of how all of these coalitions of groups would come together over a common cause and actually be not a lot of little groups, but one large force. So I'm sure that you could walk right in at the beginning. They probably weren't prepared for it at all. We were hardly prepared for it ourselves. But I mean, just for the fact that we had stopped an entire city.
The other part of it is, I think it was anything but spontaneous. What happened? It was so beautifully planned. You know, the direct action was so beautifully planned, and so carefully planned, that's something to really learn from. That's the other piece of it, is that people really organized. And then the other part, the labor part of it was very well planned too, of people, you know, reaching out, bringing people there, educating and mobilizing. So there are months and months and months of detailed organizing. And that's another thing I take from it, that's the kind of level of organizing that we have to keep promoting.
For me, the WTO and that experience just galvanized me. I think that for anyone who works in a movement, to see the number of people there and the fact that social change is possible, and that social change is possible in the United States of America. Because the reality is that WTO was stopped. And it wasn't just us on the streets in Seattle. It was also many, many nations of the global South who finally said no. WTO finally imploded, partially because of Seattle, but also, I would say, probably a much larger part because nations of the global South said, we're not going to participate because you're not dealing fairly. I think it was extremely important, however, for activists in the Global South to know that there are people in the North willing to march. To me, the inspiring or moving thing about being part of this kind of movement is that you know that you're part of an alternative, that there is a way for people in the South and the North to work for justice together, where we begin to understand that we're really facing some of the same injustices. We begin to understand that there is struggles for justice within both the South and the North. I think that the WTO march and rally was also a beginning, and many conferences and teach-ins and things that went on around that, for labor union, people of faith, environmentalists, etc., to understand that the conditions and challenges we face here in the North are very similar to conditions in the South.
Yeah. Afterwards, I started working on this video, which took, you know, months. We pieced together interviews with workers at the rally who were saying why they were there. One notable, one that just stands out in my mind is this guy from the Inland Boatmen who said he was there because he sees that people are losing jobs in this country because of, like, the WTO and institutions like the WTO. But he said, on the other hand, his heart really goes out to the people in other countries because the kinds of jobs they're getting are worse than the jobs that there are here, much poorer paid, much harder work. So those are the kind of interviews that we had that we put in a video and then started bringing around to union meetings. And in addition, in the video we showed like the Flint sit-down strike. We got some pictures of that from 1936, the sit-down strike of auto workers that helped form the CIO. And the idea was to, like, encourage people in unions to use the same strategies and tactics that people used in Seattle and is part of union background in this country, but has been pretty much lost. But to start, like, Seattle, like, seemed and still does seem like emblematic of a new way to organize, and that it's not something that's actually totally new. It actually goes back to some of the same strategies and tactics that were used by labor and other groups in this country itself. So we wanted to try and, I mean, that's a reverberation. We wanted to really try and inspire people to use the kind of strategies and tactics that made the protests in Seattle so amazingly successful, and to bring it into their daily organizing and organizing around everything from union contracts to healthcare, all the things that we need to change.
We kind of knew that we had succeeded because people knew that, hey, you know, this really caused this really, first of all, put the WTO, exposed them, put them on the map. It's so people knew what this organization was. And I think by the time we'd gotten on the bus, I think we had heard that it had really discombobulated them, and that it was, probably it slowed them down, and we didn't maybe not know that they had been shut down by then, but that it had been effective. So that was actually very, it was just something that we thought, God, you know, we could do it. And it wasn't any one person, it was just tons and tons of people that did it.
Portland had a really big part to play in that, and like I think of Portland as a center for activism and movement building in the United States, and we need to, we need to keep learning together, and we need to keep talking about our history and organizing new ways to bring people together and to keep talking about how we want to change things. And I see a lot of opportunity now to just keep organizing and to learn from the victory that was Seattle.
It was just empowering for, I had a friend who was there from Argentina, who was part of the Jubilee 2000 in Argentina, as well as a number of other justice movements in Argentina. And she's North American, married to an Argentinian, and she grew up in Seattle. So she was just kind of blown away by the numbers. It just meant a great deal to her, talking with her about it. Being able to go home to Argentina and say, wow, you know, all these people were there and were committed around this issue.
I'm actually organizing a big protest on December 5th to commemorate the 10-year anniversary of the WTO protests and to renew the call to shut down the new WTO meetings that are happening this November. So that's totally, I mean, one of the reasons I'm doing that is because it was such a transformative event in my life, and I see it as a consciousness shifting event for all these people that are in my life and also people that I don't know. And like, so it's been 10 years, and so I'm not in high school anymore. I'm an adult. I finished college about 4 years ago, and I'm still an activist, and I'm still trying to figure out how to change the world. And I feel like in Seattle, we did change the world. Like, before we went, nobody knew what the WTO was. And after, everybody did, and people still do. And that movement that shut down the WTO still exists. I think it just exists in different forms. And I think it's really good for people to remember that that was a victory. And when people talk about it, and when people who were there, people who were aware that it was happening, I see this light in their eyes. Like, I see this really, and the way that people talk about it is so amazing. Like, they recognize it as this consciousness shifting, world changing event. And so I just think we need to like remember those things more often. And since it has been 10 years, like, a good time to remember that now, and maybe we can hang on to that spirit and use it to infuse new energy into the organizing that we're doing now, which is incredibly important. And we have to do it if we're going to fix all of the problems that we're dealing with. And we have a lot of them, like this crumbling economy, for one.
I felt like we had successfully been heard and seen. If you're going to take individuals and make decisions that affect the many will not stand for it. It's gone on for too long. So I feel like what happened in Seattle 10 years ago was also a lesson to the corporate mind that is trying to impose their right to make money. You know, the WTO is basically a corporate wet dream. I mean, it's a kangaroo court that overrules governments and all in every single case that goes before the WTO rules in favor of trade, every single one. Doesn't matter if the dolphins are getting caught in the nets. It doesn't matter if lead is in the paint. I mean, even the United States lost in the lead paint debacle, where they said, well, we don't want to buy this paint, and then the WTO ruled, well, like, that's along the lines of a barrier to trade, therefore guilty, and then you have to start buying that paint. They rule every time that way, and they're not elected, and they're not representative of the people, and that kind of a sham had just gone on for too long. You know, you can't tell people what they can plant and what they can grow. If people don't want genetically modified foods, they will burn down your McDonald's. They will block your efforts to market past them. But the people have a right. So, and thank God for community media, which really flowered 10 years ago.
That's the way that I'll always remember Seattle, is just filled with all these people fighting for social justice and fighting the WTO and taking over the streets and being in solidarity with each other. So whenever I go back to Seattle, I'm kind of like, where is everybody? Like, this is, there should be more people here. It seems strange that it's not always like that.
Well, as I mentioned earlier on, I realized the morning of the final day of the ministerial that this credential around my neck has just been sitting there and I haven't used it. So I decided to go inside. I figured, well, final day, gotta go see it, can't go inside tomorrow. So I'll go and check it out. About 10 a.m., I figured I'd be out in 2 hours. Walk around, see what's happening, and then get back to the real story. Well, I got inside and I was fascinated because there were thousands of people inside the Trade and Convention Center, and this crowd on the streets was really diverse, geographically, around the world, but inside the ministerial, it was even more diverse because you did have representatives from 134, I think, countries, as well as press from probably several dozen different countries as well. And there was action everywhere. There was a banner hang, actually, inside the WTO not long after I got in there and did some early reporting about that. And yeah, came across early on an informal press briefing by some African delegates, countries I don't recall offhand, and NGOs, and representatives of NGOs from different African countries. And these folks were basically saying, we've not been included in this process. We've not had any say in the drafts coming out. We've not been given copies of any of the drafts coming out. Why should we give our consent? So at that point, I kind of realized, all right, this might not be going anywhere at all. And I kept hearing this over and over and over and over again in talking to various representatives of both official delegations and NGOs accredited to the ministerial from global South countries. And I then realized, okay, now it's more interesting in here, and forget whatever's going on out in the street. The street was over for me at that point. And I realized that the real story was now inside, and stayed inside. Another indie media reporter and I were, I think, literally the last two people out of the Trade and Convention Center at about 3 a.m., which we thought was very funny because given the level of security all week long, we joked that if we had a pallet jack and a pickup truck, we could have walked out of the ministerial with thousands and thousands of dollars worth of WTO gear, copiers, all sorts of whatnot.
Voices of November 30th. Well, you've been listening to Voices of November 30th on this, the 10th anniversary of the WTO Ministerial in Seattle. I want to thank our guests, Lori King. She's an activist with Portland Jobs with Justice. Patricia Rumer from Jubilee, Oregon. Andrea Townsend, who years ago was a student activist at Franklin High School. And from KABU, Andrew Geller, Rolf Semperbon, and Daniel Flessis. And special thanks to our editor, Paul Monday. Stay tuned for more special programming on KBOO.